Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
With the stories making headlines across the continent, this is Africa Link with me, Crispin Mwakideo, in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, residents call for increased security after the killing of a German tourist in Mombasa, Kenya.
What we're asking is security more, and this area to be taken a good security because it's the most place of tourists. That's what we want.
The 20th AIDS International Conference winds up in Melbourne, Australia, with a warning on laws that discriminate against sexual minorities.
The criminalisation of homosexuality across Africa and then these new laws in Uganda and Nigeria are significantly impeding our ability to bring the AIDS crisis under control.
Stick around for that story and more as we also bring to you the winners of the latest Africa Link Listeners Contest.
Top story.
From bad to worse. Kenyan police on Friday say they had arrested one suspect in connection with the death of a German female tourist. The German lady in her late 20s was touring Mombasa's old town in the company of her Ugandan boyfriend. He too was shot and is said to be recovering in hospital. The murder of the German brings to two the number of foreign tourists killed in the town this month. From Mombasa, Eric Ponda reports.
The Kibokoni area is home to many historical sites, such as the Fort Jesus, built in the 18th century by the Portuguese settlers. It's the same spot where another female tourist, a Russian national, was shot dead on 6th of this month. The German tourist was shot at a close range in the neck. Her Ugandan partner was admitted to the Coast General Hospital with bullet wounds sustained during the incident. Shocked residents say one of the assailants had a pistol, appeared around a corner, and then shot the tourist who was trying to exchange foreign currency. The assailant then escaped. One resident explained what happened.
Some people are rushing to the mosque, some people are coming from work. Then abruptly we just had some shots when we were in the mosque. And when we came out, we found one man already being shot as a woman. So there's nobody who have a clue about these people. But what we're asking is security more, and this area to be taken a good security because it's the most place of tourists. That's what we want, and our families and our relatives.
The killings punches holes on the security apparatus in Mombasa as the incident occurred just 500 meters from the central police station, despite the increased police patrols in the area. The chairman of the Security Council of Kibokoni Old Town, Khalid Ibrahim, said there's no doubt that this is a big blow to the tourism industry, which is already on its knees. Police are still investigating the motive behind the killings, as there was no sign of robbery. The incident came after police had increased patrols carrying out door-to-door search in Likoni and Majengo area in Mombasa, where six people were killed early this week. Speaking to the press, the Mombasa County Commandant Robert Kitur says they have recovered an AK-47, a grenade and several rounds of ammunition. The suspect being held by police for interrogation is believed to be among a group of youths out to cause panic in Mombasa and its environs.
These are purely criminals trained to cause mayhem, but we won't relax our efforts because we don't want to see locals or foreigners visiting our country killed. We must deal with the situation as it comes.
However, another senior official has suggested there might be a political motive behind the killings. Early this week, United States Aviation Agency designated Kenya as a hostile region for U.S. aircrafts in its latest advisory and prohibition notice. The Federal Aviation Administration notice also lists Ethiopia on its full prohibition list and restates Somalia as a no-go area for U.S. aircrafts. Al-Shabaab militants have continued to carry out what is seen as revenge attacks on the Kenyan soil since the Kenyan Defense Forces entered Somalia in 2011. Over 100 people have been killed in Lamu District in the recent weeks.
Eric Ponda reporting. Mombasa, famous for its white sandy beaches and luxurious palm-fringed hotels, is struggling to cope with low tourist arrivals. The drop is linked to rising insecurity, which has been blamed on Somalia's Al-Shabaab militants. Lucy Karume is chairperson of the Task Force for the Recovery of Kenyan Tourism. She told me the killings are a huge setback. For technical reasons, we've had to voice over her answers.
This is horrific and it's shocking because...
This is horrific and destructive because we've never had a target on tourists in this country. How much has this set us back? It has set us back on what we've been trying to put forward. So we're saying that we're getting over and done with this insecurity problem. We know that the government is on the case and is trying to find out what really happened or who the people responsible for this act are.
But this is the second such killing in a month in Mombasa. How does one even begin to convince foreign tourists that Mombasa is actually safe for them?
very, very difficult, my dear.
It is very, very difficult, because before you concluded with one case of a tourist being shot and then a second comes in, it sends a very difficult signal about the country's security. It is also difficult to answer how do we continue from here. It's even hard to say where are these people, who are these people, and why all of a sudden are they targeting tourists?
And you don't have any answers to those questions as of now?
I don't have any answer to these questions. Investigations are still going on, and we have requested to have a meeting with Internal Security Cabinet Secretary Olelenku as a private sector in tourism, so that he can actually give us an insight into what he might know, what may have gone wrong.
Several Western countries have issued travel advisories on Kenya. Do you think such action is justified?
The word justified becomes very difficult.
Because they all have a different scope. The earlier travel advisory were based on incidents that happened along the coast of Lamu and not in Mombasa. And that led a number of tourists to leave the country. Is this justifiable? I cannot use the word justifiable because they are all different.
And how would you describe the state of Kenya's tourism industry under the current circumstances?
I would prefer to break down the status into different regions.
Because in Masai Mara, as you know, the migration came early, so we do have good numbers in Masai Mara. In other areas, such as in Nairobi, life is moving. The coast has really taken a beating with all the issues that have been happening. Tourism is way down on the coast. And that is my focus on recovery, to see how we can actually get the coast area to at least start picking up.
What exactly is your task force doing to boost the ailing sector?
First and foremost, to work as closely as possible
with internal security, because that is where the core of the matter seems to be lying. We need to find out from the security minister when he is going to deploy the 600-man tourism police unit on the ground. At the moment, we have got 200 men who are doing a good job, but they are not sufficient. We need to get more soldiers on the ground, primarily to protect tourists.
Lucy Karume talking about efforts to revamp Kenya's tourism sector.
Africa Link, bringing you the story behind the story.
Welcome back. A Liberian man who died in Nigeria's mega city of Lagos on Friday has tested positive for the deadly Ebola virus. That's according to a statement by Nigeria's Minister of Health, Onyebuchi Chukwu. West Africa is battling the worst Ebola virus outbreak in history, which has so far claimed 660 lives. Our correspondent Samuel Okoya in Lagos has been telling me more about this story.
Well, very little is known about him. It was just on Thursday the announcement was made that the man who was had been quarantined shortly after he arrived in Nigeria from Liberia. He was taken to a private hospital and they said the symptoms he had were very much consistent with those of the Ebola virus. And I think the initial test actually showed this, but then they had to make two other tests outside the country. And while this was being awaited, the announcement of his death, it was announced that he had died.
And is it known how many people he came into contact with after arriving in Lagos?
Well, I mean, he must have come in contact with from some people, right from the airport, the hospital where he was kept, and then those who may be relatives, I'm not sure, but definitely he must have made a bit of contact with people.
How would you describe the mood in Lagos after the news that an Ebola patient entered Nigeria and is now dead?
Well, I think the mood is one of apprehension. First, the news that Ebola is in Nigeria, and then while Nigerians are still trying to figure out the best way out, and then the next thing everybody's hearing is that the person who contracted this thing has died. So it's one of fear. It's the signs of death, as far as many are concerned, is a bit imminent if this thing were to spread. And given that the first patient was found in Lagos, and Lagos is highly populous, the way people live, they live in very crowded environment, and it's believed if there are to be more cases, then it could be very, very devastating. So I went around Lagos, and these are the reaction I got from people concerning the death of the man.
I feel really bad, and I feel really afraid about the situation. My parents have called me from outside Lagos to ask me that they are afraid that I should use my protective gloves, I should use my face mask, that how am I going to face the situation? So I'm really afraid.
There is now concerns for me personally that somebody in Lagos now has this virus. And from what I've read about this virus, it's very deadly if infected. I'm just hoping the ministry, health ministry, will take the appropriate measures to see that this thing is being contained, even while burying him, and the hospital where he was treated and the staff there should just be handled very properly.
What has been the official reaction so far?
Well, not much has come in terms of official reaction, apart from the announcement, the initial announcement by the officials of the Lagos State government that they found a case, and then the second reaction had been concerning the death of this man. Of course, before now, the government had been, especially in Lagos State, the government had been announcing that people should learn habits that could prevent the spread of this, and I think with it now being with us, then it's going to be a bit difficult if it were to spread.
So what you're saying is that the Lagos government had initially tried to put people on alert on the outbreak of Ebola?
Yes, the Lagos state government had taken steps to tell Nigerians that they should have some sanitary behavior which will help in preventing this. And of course, I mean... for a disease that was in other West African countries, as far as many people are concerned, it will be a matter of time before it gets to Nigeria, given that Nigerians travel a lot to some of these West African countries where Ebola had been was known to have killed people.
Sam Olukoya in Lagos. And when we return, a warning from experts on HIV/AIDS. You're listening to DW's Africa Link.
Human rights.
The cut that hurts. Female genital mutilation, often referred to as FGM, involves the cutting of the external female genitalia. Many girls in Africa, the Middle East, and even Europe have bled to death as a result of this cultural practice. It is against this backdrop that international leaders attending a girls' summit in London call for the elimination of FGM within 10 years. Naomi Conrad met a Dutch Somali activist fighting to end the tradition and filed this report.
Back in the 1990s, when Sahra Nalela first took up the fight against the men and women who mutilate babies and toddlers, her mother was dismayed.
In the beginning, she said that, you know, it is not suited to work about this work because you are against the people. They see for you as an enemy because you are against their tradition and their religion and their customs. So please avoid this one and look another work.
Zahra shrugs. She had decided to fight the practice of female genital mutilation, or FGM as it is commonly referred to, a procedure that involves cutting the external genitalia and sometimes stitching up the wound, leaving only a tiny opening for urine and blood to pass through. The long-term effects are terrible. Infections, incontinence, chronic pain and trauma. Many girls and babies bleed to death in the process that is widespread in both Africa and the Middle East, but also among migrant communities in Europe, including in the Netherlands, where Zahra had moved to complete a master's degree. Surely, her mother back in Somalia reasoned, Zahra could do better things with her European degree than fight a practice which was commonplace in her home country. Zahra ignored her pleas.
And I say to her, yeah, because I have started somewhere and it comes from my heart and I would like to go ahead. So I think when you are working such taboo things, it is very, very difficult. But, you know, if you will not start, you know, all these campaigns, look, you know, before, you know, food binding in China, sat in India, it was another issue.
Zahra smiles and adjusts her knotted headscarf. In the beginning, her work was hard, she says. She received abuse, even threats from those who considered FGM an integral part of their culture. It was impossible to get men and women to sit down and even discuss the topic. She's in Berlin for a conference of FGM activists who work with African communities in Germany, the Netherlands, Sweden and the UK. The activists agree that attitudes are slowly changing. The new generation which has grown up in Europe is no longer prepared to put its daughters through the pain and suffering they themselves experienced. Some communities have given up FGM almost altogether. Some, but not all. Last year, a mother came into the clinic. She lives in Berlin with her 5-year-old daughter, who spent the summer holidays with her father in Somalia. Cornelia Strunz is a doctor at the Desert Flower Medical Center in Berlin, which offers reconstructive surgery and counseling to 3 to 4 victims of female circumcision every month. A huge banner dominates the entrance to the clinic. A black woman and her daughter smile down at the patients below.
The mother was afraid that her daughter might have been circumcised during the holidays. She was extremely concerned. But fortunately, we were able to reassure her.
Not every story has such a happy ending. In Europe, some 180,000 girls are at risk, according to a study released by the European Parliament in 2009. It's a rough estimate. No one knows how many girls end up being cut during the holidays or may be submitted to the procedure in the future.
That report was compiled by Naomi Conrad. South Africa's port city of Durban will host the 21st International AIDS Conference in 2016. The announcement came at the end of the 20th AIDS Conference in Australia on Friday, with delegates giving a warning that discriminatory laws and policies are undermining efforts to curb the disease. Anti-gay laws passed in Nigeria and Uganda were cited as an example. I asked Jonathan Cooper, Chief Executive of Human Dignity Trust in London and also a human rights lawyer, whether the warning will be taken seriously.
The warning has to be taken seriously. The criminalisation of homosexuality across Africa and then these new laws in Uganda and Nigeria are significantly impeding our ability to bring the AIDS crisis under control. I mean, with criminalisation, not only does it cause HIV infections, it also boosts HIV infections. So we have to take that warning shot that was sounded in Melbourne very seriously, and the Durban conference really must ensure that it does all it can to guarantee that these laws that persecute the gay and lesbian community are consigned to the dustbin of history.
And how do these laws, these anti-gay laws, actually undermine the fight against HIV and AIDS?
Well, it effectively criminalises men who have sex with men. Well, it does criminalise men who have sex with men, and so therefore they become beyond the reach of those who are seeking to provide HIV prevention information and material. So, for example, in Uganda, a month or so back, one of the main organisations that provides information to people most at risk of HIV and AIDS was closed down. Other organisations have been told that they are under review because they may be promoting homosexuality. There was a court case in Uganda recently that found that the gay and lesbian community could not meet together to discuss issues, including HIV prevention, because by doing that, they were inciting and conspiring to commit criminal offences. And so these criminal laws are putting not only the gay community of Uganda and Nigeria and in the other jurisdictions where there are these criminal laws, they're not only putting them at risk, they're putting the entire population of those jurisdictions at risk, because of course men who have sex with men also have sex with women, and therefore you are extending the problem of HIV into the general population. And so these criminal laws put everyone at risk of HIV transmission and mean that there is no genuine prospect of ever achieving a zero transmission objective, which is clearly the objective of UNAIDS and other organisations. But whilst these criminal laws are in place, and we have to remember that these criminal laws are a legacy of British colonial rule, you only get these laws in jurisdictions where the British were. In other jurisdictions, for example, in Francophone Africa, they didn't criminalise, and so therefore these criminal laws don't exist in those jurisdictions. They are a legacy of British colonial rule. And so we have to remove these criminal laws if we are going to achieve a zero transmission policy around HIV and AIDS.
Well, ironically, these African countries which have enacted or are debating these anti-gay laws argue that it's also a measure to curb the spread of HIV. What's your take on that?
All the evidence, absolutely all the evidence, suggests the contrary. You will not get the HIV epidemic under control whilst you are criminalising groups of individuals who are most vulnerable to HIV. If you have criminal laws in place, that means you can't effectively target men who have sex with men, because you may be, as far as that particular criminal law is concerned, breaching that particular law. And so you end up with these absurd statistics. For example, in Lesotho, 86% of men who have sex with men have no notion of the risk factors involved in having sex with another man. They have no understanding that that actually puts them more at risk rather than less at risk. And there's a similar statistic in Zambia, where 73% of men who have sex with men think it is safer to have sex with a man than it is to have sex with a woman. And so these criminal laws can perpetuate this level of ignorance, and with that ignorance comes increased HIV prevention. The criminal laws also encourage anonymous and unsafe sex, hence the crisis, the AIDS crisis continues. And with the criminal laws comes brutal policing, and therefore pushes the AIDS crisis even more underground. And so the idea that you need these laws to bring the crisis under control, it's just absurd. It's fatuous. I mean, there's absolutely no basis for that assertion, and all the evidence suggests the contrary.
Human rights lawyer Jonathan Cooper in London.
USA.
And now is the time of the week when we take a look at our mailbox, our inbox and our text messages. Sela Oneko joined me in the studio shortly before we came on air.
Hi, Crispin. So, as you and our listeners know, our Africa on the Move quiz ended this week. And all over those 3 weeks, we've had nearly 200 participants. Some of you sent in more than one answer, so I spent my time sifting through about 450 separate answers.
Wow, that must have taken quite some time. I remember you coming around the office asking all of us to pick the names out of the box. So the winners were selected at random.
Yes, and we found three winners. Our top winner is Richard Agye Afranyi from Ghana, to whom we are sending a tablet. So congratulations, Richard. I contacted Richard this morning and he wrote back, "I'm so happy, words can't describe." He also says that he not only listens to Africa Link, but watches our TV program and follows DW English on Facebook and Twitter.
Well, congratulations, Richard, and keep it DW. And I have the names of the other two winners, which are Albert Chama from Lusaka, Zambia, and James Martus Ponpon from Liberia. They have each won a Deutsche Welle smartphone, so congratulations to you all.
Yes, and we also have a few smaller prizes for the top 10 winners, whom I've already contacted. They include a DW football or a T-shirt or some other small souvenirs.
Great. So a big thanks again to everybody for listening or visiting our website and taking part in the quiz. We hope you had fun as much as we did and learned something.
Yes, and on that note, I wanted to read out one more message from a participant. It's from George Albert Anye from Kampala. He wrote that he learned a number of things, and he says that he's very interested in livestock and agriculture. So, being in Uganda, he plans to get in touch and learn more from the pig farmer Emma Nayulima, who featured in our Africa on the Move section last week.
So we are actually connecting the dots, eh? From field to our studio in Bonn, back to the listener. Great.
Yes, well, that's all from me this week. Next week, we'll be back to checking your comments on the things that are happening all over the continent.
Thank you so much, Sela. You can respond to topics covered on Africa Link or on our website by sending us a text message on +491609575910, an email to feedback.africa@dw.de, or a letter to Africa Link, DW53110, Bonn, Germany. You'll say we'll be back at the same time next week.
Harare, Nairobi, or Abuja. Africa Link correspondents reporting for you from wherever the story breaks.
Right, and before we break for the weekend, here's a quick summary of our main stories. Kenyan police have arrested a suspect in connection with the killing of a German tourist. Nigerian health officials have confirmed that a Liberian man who died in a quarantine Lagos hospital tested positive for the deadly Ebola virus. And HIV/AIDS experts have warned that discriminatory laws are hampering the fight against the disease. And there we've come to the end of this edition of Africa Link. Isaac Mugabe will be here next week. From me, Crispin Mwakideu, and the entire Africa Link crew, have a pleasant and safe weekend.